S was the place to be. My review of the literature yielded little insight into future events. We would not follow through on our promised Marshall Plan for Afghanistan. We would allow the Taliban in Pakistan to reorganize and redeploy. Iraq would consume our attention and drain the U.S. Treasury of perhaps $2 trillion. Rumsfeld's Department of Defense would fail to adjust to a new, emerging era of conflict in which non-state actors, as enemies and allies, play a major role. I introduced myself to Professor Cohen, who led the Strategic Studies Department. We sat in his corner office and chatted about the academic rigors of the program. He thought and spoke clearly, directly, with a concise and efficient manner. I liked him immediately. He knew that I was a CIA officer on academic sabbatical. At this point in my career, a cover was more hindrance than help. After 4 years of counterterrorism work, almost every liaison service in every country knew my identity. So did many terrorist groups. AQ had placed a bounty on all CIA officers in Afghanistan, including me. The academic community posed a minimal threat. At least I hoped so. Nevertheless, there was no need for the professors and staff to know about my role in Afghanistan or any other specifics of my career. I wanted less attention, not more. I preferred less talk about Afghanistan and more about war and intelligence as disciplines. I wanted less discussion about operations and more about strategy and policy. During the first semester, I reread Sun Tzu's The Art of War and parts of Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War. I studied Clausewitz's On War and John Keegan's The Face of Battle. There was so much to explore, from stunning political and economic changes in China to the emerging violent reformation within Islam. There was the increasing irrelevance of NATO, the stunning growth of democracy in Latin America, and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Cyberspace offered new intelligence collection platforms and battlefields. The first semester afforded broad views of policy and strategy, drawing from lessons throughout the ages. Perhaps the most simple and important observation, the stunning miscalculations of leaders, particularly those who cling to archaic military concepts and behaviors. The horrors of the U.S. Civil War's trench warfare were repeated and magnified 50 years later in World War I. How could generals not adapt to the brutal fact of concentrated rapid-fire weapons? Instead, they commanded millions of men as if they carried single-shot muskets and sabers. How could the U.S. military resist the advent of the tank and the aircraft as powerful weapons that change war? How could the United States blunder so badly in Vietnam? I read how our conventional generals resisted the nascent but effective counterinsurgency warriors, yet pandered to the policy leaders and refused to tell them the harsh, ugly truth about the Vietnamese enemy. Meanwhile, the political leaders lied to the American people. The Vietnam era illustrated a breakdown of the essential trust between the soldier, the state, and the nation. With this inherent resistance to change, how would the United States face a new non-state enemy like Al-Qaeda? How to deal with a brutal enemy who leveraged asymmetric weapons and tactics and operated on an increasingly fragile global battlefield? The convergence of our recent history and counterterrorist operations with the intellectual rigor of SAIS, reaching back through centuries of scholarship, brought into focus what a fundamental shift in warfare I had just lived through. Three facts leaped to the fore. First, the degree of asymmetry in warfare had reached a new level. The trend was not just increasing, but accelerating at an alarming rate. Fewer and fewer operatives could bring more and more death and destruction. Weapons were growing more powerful, Population and infrastructure targets were growing more condensed and fragile. Beyond the kinetic impact, single operatives with a computer virus, horrible video, or angry exhortation could upload to the web and have immediate global impact. Second, the role of non-state actors was increasing. AQ and other terrorist groups were challenging nation-states as threats to our homeland. And non-state allies, such as Afghan tribes, served as more effective allies than traditional ones, such as NATO. The number and importance of these non-state actors were proliferating. NGOs, media, business, universities, religious groups, and more. Public opinion in all parts of the world would matter more and more. Although these actors and their views were part of the strategic landscape, our strategic planning still seldom factored them into the equation. Third, at an operational, even tactical level, the battlefield was now global. An enemy group could plot and plan on one side of the planet and execute on the other side in days, if not hours. In cyberspace, impact could be measured in seconds. If these emerging and converging factors were changing the nature of warfare, then what was the role of intelligence? How would we identify and discern these micro-actors with macro-impact bouncing around a global battlefield, burrowing into the human terrain and employing deception and denial tactics? Intelligence seemed to be getting harder even as it was becoming more important. Respected scholars like John Keegan rejected the value of intelligence in war. So did some policymakers. Would this shift in the nature of war change their views? Would academia consider intelligence a subject worthy of study, perhaps even worthy of a unique and separate discipline? Would policy leaders rethink the value of intelligence? I needed to study these questions, so I signed up for a class on intelligence taught by Professor Jennifer Sims and called The Art and Tradecraft of Intelligence. Professor Sims constructed an elegant theory of intelligence based on enduring historical principles, a theory that stressed the dynamic integration of collection and analysis with customer feedback loops. Before the course, I had to admit that I was ignorant about theories of intelligence. I had no idea how poorly the academic community treated the subject, perhaps a reflection of how the U.S. government and society thought of intelligence operatives, like a necessary but filthy work crew used for jobs nobody else wanted or even cared to discuss, or a romanticized heroic mirage that entertained but failed to inform. In some respects, academia treated intelligence no differently than the FBI or the Defense Department did. It was not a core discipline. What leaders in the FBI, defense, state, or any other line policy department had climbed the intelligence ranks to a command position in their organization? What academic leader had achieved success through studying intelligence? Professor Sims and I eventually cooked up the idea of an academic text, published in 2005 by Georgetown University Press, titled Transforming U.S. Intelligence. Sims and Burton Gerber were the co-editors. I contributed a couple of chapters. Of the many things I learned while at SAIS, there are three related to intelligence that stand out. The first is how ambivalent, cynical, or ignorant the U.S. public and many policymakers are about intelligence. In spring 2003, I witnessed the unfolding fiasco of the Iraq War. Some policymakers claimed that the intelligence, flat wrong on weapons of mass destruction, made them invade, as if there were no choices. In the coming years, other leaders would reject the CIA's early descriptions of a rapidly emerging Iraqi insurgency because it contradicted their sense of preordained victory. I recalled Wolfowitz's comments in the White House in September 2001. Policymakers were seeking to drive intelligence conclusions rather than letting intelligence collection and analysis inform policy. Second, I was struck by the changing nature of warfare and the growing importance of intelligence in this strategic context. Unlike in Afghanistan, we launched a war against the country of Iraq while utterly ignoring our most important ally, the Iraqi people. The Iraqis were a disorganized collection of non-state actors seeking to regain their pride and prestige. This war was not state on state, no matter how much U.S. civilian and military leadership wanted it to be. This was a war about and among the people. Our leaders, stumbling along this uncertain path in this new conflict environment, demanded more and more intelligence. This was reflected in huge budget increases in the intelligence community and a proliferation of agencies with intelligence functions, but little real strategic leadership or clarity. The intelligence